We have guest Edgar Meyer in the studio here at WMUK, superstar bassist, and who's ready to play a solo recital tomorrow night as the season opening concert for Fontana Chamber Arts. Hello, Edgar.
Hello, how are you?
I'm pretty good. Really thrilled to have you here. And also, David Baldwin is here, who is the executive director of Fontana Chamber Arts. And I imagine you are thrilled to be starting the fall season with this concert.
I can't think of a better way to start it. We're absolutely, absolutely excited and thrilled with it. And it's very indicative of Fontana's type of programming to have this kind of thing where you have artists of the highest quality, but it's just a little bit different and has a twist to it. And so we're excited about that.
Genre bending is one phrase that could be associated with you, Edgar. And the double bass is your primary instrument, which is another unusual thing. We don't often see solo bassists saying, I'll just take the spotlight and a stool and play music for you for a full program. And this is a program that has a lot of variety to it. We go from Bach to one of your own works that is in progress, and some tunes that maybe are associated with folk and other types of music. I'm hardly aware of where to begin, Edgar.
You're doing fine.
Well, thanks. I understand that it was your father who put the bass into your hands when you were young.
Well, I put it into my hands. I was calling for it. I mean, I saw my father play, and, you know, he really loved music, and so his enthusiasm was, you know, it's simply transferred. And so from even before I could talk, I was pretending I was playing, and just wanted to be like him.
He knew a lot about string playing.
Well, in a way, you know, but he taught elementary, junior high, and high school. He taught taught orchestra, and I remember being a youngster and putting all those tapes on all those violins and getting them strung up and things. But he just was very passionate about it. He really loved it, and so there's a lot of reverence for music in our house, and that's how things got going.
When did you really become very focused on gaining that kind of facility on the double bass that would allow you to play music at the highest level?
I was always ambitious, but I think part of it was not even as much ambition as it was. I just remember being in fourth grade, and I was reading my father's, one of his college books about orchestration, some kind of orchestration text. And it talked about what the violins could play and what they couldn't play, and then it talked about what the bassists could play and what they couldn't play. It just didn't make any sense to me. You know, he said, well, don't write this for the bassist because it ain't going to happen. And then they said, but you can do all this for the violin. And I was like, well, wait a minute. You know, and even puzzling for me hearing my father play the violin badly and the bass well, it didn't even, it was just, and there was just, I think, a natural tendency to want to just see what the instrument could do.
Where did you continue your education, and did you work with any great teachers along the way?
Well, I started at Georgia Tech and was more of a math or physics major, and was co-oping at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, so quarter on, quarter off, you know. Then I transferred to Indiana and remained a math major for a while, and it just ended up doing music 24/7, so I switched to being a music major at some point. And I ran into Stuart Sankey there, who's a teacher of mine, and it was good because I had really not been very accepting of teachers before him. I kind of knew how I wanted to play, and I wasn't very happy. I wasn't very patient with being told things that I didn't agree with. And Stuart's approach was very different. He would get inside what I was doing and get excited about it and then try to help me do it, which just made a lot more sense to me. I've tried to, as a teacher, do that. I don't really do it. I'm a little, but I'm aware that that's a possible dimension. I guess at the end of the day with teaching, there's not a formula. I mean, you really actually have to react to each student, and what might have worked for me when I was 20 might not be what the next 20-year-old needs. And so I try to stay flexible, but I'm aware of the possibility of somebody coming in like myself. And in fact, I'm quite attuned to it. But regarding teachers, though, I do like to feel like my music education has, you know, been pretty continuous for 52 years. I don't feel like the collegiate part was even a high point. It was important, but, with all the remarkable people that I've worked with, I've learned immense amounts from. You know, if I get out a score of Bach and Beethoven, I look at them as teachers. I just feel like it's a lifelong process. And I'm honestly puzzled at the idea of a focused, 4 years and that's it. That's just, I draw a blank at that.
Well, you're a self-teacher, lifelong self-teacher. We have a professor of bass here at Western, Tom Knifick, who may be of the same generation.
And that's right.
He was here just last week, and we were talking about your concert coming up, and he said, you know, when I was a bassist around college age, I don't think I knew Edgar. He might have crossed paths at some point, but he said he was dreaming of a bassist. Who it was, he didn't know, but a bassist who could...
have a solo career.
Yes, have the solo career, cross genres, and have it not be, a big deal. You know, this just needed to happen. And he's like, and then Edgar came along. Kind of stepped into those shoes.
You know, the business with the genres is a complex, but I think generally poorly understood issue. I guess at the root of it is that a lot of the divisions are imperfect and false at some points, and it's tricky because some of them are real. There really is a difference between bluegrass and Italian opera, but there really is a lot of similarity between lots of different music, and there are a lot of categories that are created and morphed, you know, for little more than purposes of commerce or just people's individual kind of turf. And so you have a big sticky mess as to what's real and what's not. And then additionally, you have fields of study, for example, if you want to play concertos on the piano, that body, you know, even just playing Mozart concertos is already, you know, a pretty massive undertaking. And so there's maybe not time to learn all the different things if one takes that, whereas if the double bass, there's no repertoire. There's nothing to play. You got some time. Mm. So, and then the bass also has the indigenous involvement in other types of music, so that's... also a great starting place. But the truth of the matter is, it's also just indicative of the time. Andre Previn was really quite accomplished in classical music and in jazz. And, I mean, is accomplished. And it's just not been in the prime of his career, it wasn't taken seriously. Whereas if it happened now, I think it would be a completely different ballgame.
It's almost like if as a fan, you like classical music, you just don't understand why your favorite artist would play jazz. And also, if you love the music and a very talented performer crosses over and makes an album, an opera singer does Gershwin, for example, if they don't work very hard to learn that music, they can sound like someone speaking English with a strange accent.
I'd go further. I'd just say it sounds terrible.
I was being more diplomatic.
But you do. I'm proud of my young friend and colleague, Chris Thiele, you know, it's the opposite. You know, he's working a pretty broad platform stylistically. And, you know, it's just that from age five, he was pursuing all these different musics with the same kind of intensity, you know, that you expect, you know, of somebody who's serious about music. And so when he shows up and is playing, it's not, at that point, it's just not crossing over. It's just who he is, you know. And so I think that's also, I'm curious to see how it evolves. If, you know, if Chris is just another anomaly, or if that's more indicative of what's beginning to happen. I don't know.
Tell me about Bach suites on cello, which were written for Baroque cello. And when did you first adapt them to double bass?
I started playing them around age 11. And I just read the part, you know. I mean, I never really changed any notes. And I love that music. I guess I was already playing some of it on the piano. And it's very interesting because, you know, Bach sells itself, but I do clearly also remember all the things that were written about Bach had an influence on me at that age. And these were not, you know, the drier types of prose that you might see now. These were, you know, late 19th century, early 20th century, more fantastic, almost ecstatic, you know, writing about Bach and putting it on just an unbelievable pedestal, which is actually okay. But I remember those writings even having an influence and just thinking, you know, it's just had this almost religious importance in terms of understanding music. So I was just excited to open up, you know, a book that was written for a bass clef instrument and try to figure out how to play it.
Let's take a break and listen to Edgar Meyer's recording of the Suite Number 1 by Bach. We'll hear one or two movements, perhaps, and come back and talk about the rest of the program. I should tell our listeners again, concerts at 8 o'clock tomorrow night in the Dalton Center Recital Hall, and full information is on the Fontana Chamber Arts website, fontanachamberarts.org.
Thank you.
That's my guest here this morning, Edgar Meyer, with music from the Bach Cello Suite Number 1, played on double bass, of course. And David, you and I were mentioning that it almost sounds exactly like a cello recording, except when those bass notes come out.
Then you can hear the full richness, certainly,
really.
Yeah.
And in person, in the Dalton Center Recital Hall, a wonderfully resonant hall, that will come through beautifully, I
sure.
think. The concert is tomorrow night at 8 o'clock in the Dalton Center Recital Hall, and it starts with the Suite Number 1 by Bach and continues with an original work by Mr. Meyer, simply called Work in Progress. Edgar, I was wondering if you took any inspiration from Bach in this new piece?
Well, I would say not directly. I take inspiration from Bach, you know, every minute that I'm alive. But at the same time, there's probably, outside of writing a piece for a solo bass clef instrument, there's not a lot of direct, depends. I guess you could, you know, the opening movement starts slow, then has a fast section, and has a slow section, almost like some of those more French overture kind of things that Bach does sometimes. But it's just the connection is maybe twice removed. At the same time, I'm probably, of people who write music, I think, you know, my primary sources are 18th and 19th century classical music, and probably combined with things like bluegrass and jazz and even Indian music, that are very much in evolution in this century and, or in the past century, especially. And, so in that sense, you know, there's most of the stuff I write has both a sensibility and maybe even a frame to it that is very 18th or 19th century, which, you know, is, like I say, maybe only once removed. So maybe it's very Bach influenced, but it doesn't sound like Bach, I'll say that. And it doesn't, I don't think anybody, educated or not, would jump to the conclusion that it was very tied to Bach.
Well, in the sense that Bach showed how one might suggest harmonies and place things on the instrument, that's a very helpful guideline or a map to all future pieces.
It's true. And you could probably find other, you know, many other things like that, but I guess I just don't... I'm careful about not referring to my own music within, you know, two or three, without, you know, several bumpers between me and Bach.
Well, I think it's rather brave of you to bring a piece on tour that you haven't put the final, you know, haven't stamped it the end and sent it off to be printed. This is still a work in some
flux. Well, you know, the whole program is a work in progress, honestly, and that's really more the nature of music for me. You know, I'm usually workshopping things, and sometimes, you know, if I'm unlucky, I actually, you know, pass the best point, and move on to something that's not quite as good, but hopefully not too often. And I started wanting to play programs alone about 4 or 5 years ago, and I've just been, it was more challenging than I expected. I don't know if it's because I'm older or if it's 52, not that old, but not that young. The actual reality of just trying to keep people's attention, you know, and connect with people over the course of an evening with only a bass. It does present challenges in terms of both in terms of the playing and the conception. So, but as time passes, I am actually just relishing the challenge and look forward to each one, you know, a little more.
Other than the piano, though, I imagine that's true of most solo instruments because, like a solo flute recital in one night or even, the violin and the cello repertoire is much more vast, but a solo flute, a solo French horn, a solo tuba, you know, that'd be pretty challenging.
It's true. Yeah. And even I noticed that my friend Chris Thiele, who is, as talented as any one human, when he's doing these solo shows this fall, he's actually going to sing on them.
Right.
So I think that's getting out a little easy, Chris.
Right.
And he's already got an instrument that plays chords easily.
Exactly.
So I think part of it, as you say, and it boils down a lot of it to just that whole idea of one of the more effective ways to create is to limit the parameters from the outset. This is a fairly extreme example, but that's exactly what it is. In theory, one should be able to take these four strings and a bow and ought to be able to have something to say.
Yeah, I think you're quoting Stravinsky. I think he said he'd prefer to be given a commission for piccolo, triangle, and tuba than something open-ended,
right,
just to have that.
Well, that's the idea.
Yeah.
I'd prefer something open-ended.
One of the things that struck me in listening to the Bach suites, I know bassists, and I know, I can picture as I watch them play, there is difficulty getting up and down that long neck and landing in pitch. And darn it, you are really in tune all the time. And I don't know how you do it.
Well, you know, it's actually a bigger target, to be honest.
You have more wiggle room?
Physically, sure. Mm. If the window is 2 cents sharp or flat, that's a bigger physical distance on a bass. I can look at students and not hear them, and a lot of time I can see if they're pretty close to pitch or not. I wouldn't say there's any real advantages to it. I mean, the bass is difficult. I'm not going to. But one of the things that's very important to do in a program like this is to, and I may do more of that in the second half, is a little bit in the first half too, is to look for things that the bass does that aren't hard on the bass, that just kind of seem to fall out of the instrument and that are natural. And you got to have both, honestly. You got to have some of these things where it just feels like the bass was born to that. And then you've also got to have stuff that really represents, kind of the triumph of mind over matter. And I think the combination of those kind of elements is what can give it, some breadth and maybe a little more interest. I think if one leans just on one side of that, it's more narrow.
I had a guest here once, an esteemed Baroque cellist named Honor Bilsma.
Right.
Who...
He says stuff.
He said something that blew my mind and is still something I think about all the time. He said, if the piano had not become so prevalent in the 19th century, our idea of pitch would be more based on strings and string playing, and it would be much more flexible than it is today. We'd have more appreciation for these smaller variations.
He's right, but so what?
But just imagine a world without pianos.
There is not that world. That world exists nowhere.
This is the one we have.
Yes.
Back to your idea of being inspired by 19th century music as well. That made me rush to the CD player and put in my favorite moment from your concerto for double bass and orchestra with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. And it's this sort of duet with clarinet and bass in the second movement.
I really
love it. And that does bring to mind just great moments from 19th century music and Brahms or maybe even opera. I love what you did here.
It is a little vocal. It's got an operatic dimension. Honestly, though, because of something about the expression, and it sounds kind of oddly French. Honestly, it doesn't sound like anything like that. It's just the actual inspiration, and a very important, the one place I stole directly was just the texture, the Haydn C major violin concerto, which is just a glorious piece, has a slow movement where the strings are pizzicato accompanying the violin soloist.
Well, I'd like to play that now, and I'd like to remind listeners that the concert is tomorrow night at 8 o'clock in the Dalton Center Recital Hall, a presentation of Fontana Chamber Arts, opening its season on Saturday. More information available online at fontanachamberarts.org or by calling 269-382-7774. We just heard the middle movement of the Concerto for Double Bass and Orchestra by Edgar Meyer, who is here in the studio at WMUK with me to talk about his concert tomorrow night at 8 o'clock in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. But now is a really good opportunity to talk about taking on these bigger ensemble pieces and writing for great soloists, not just yourself, but Joshua Bell or Hilary Hahn and Yo-Yo Ma. And these sound like dreams come true for any musician.
Well, I guess I've benefited immensely from kind of the synergy between playing and writing. It's probably, given me access as a composer that just simply because I know all these people as players. And it wouldn't work without both sides in place, I think. But, I think more important, even more importantly than the professional benefits, which are, wonderful, I just think that the playing and the writing belong together. I think classical music has hit a fairly dysfunctional place creatively, and it's been there for a long time. And I would say that nothing is more fundamental to the difficulties than the separation of the writing and the playing.
You really are a 19th century guy.
Well, it keeps the music from evolving. And so the, most evolution, in the last 70 years has really been cosmetic. And also, I guess to really be tough, creativity is kind of hard to do with 80 people waiting around. It's easier in groups of 3 and 4 people. It's just easier to turn things over and try something else. So anyway, that's hard, sorry to be so harsh, but it's, you know, the flip side is I love writing for orchestra. It's fun. And it's, you know, it's almost in my blood. I mean, it's, my father would put on these recordings of violin concertos every Sunday morning, Heifetz and Oistrakh and, you know, Bach and Beethoven violin concertos and Brahms. And, you know, and that was, you know, before going to church, but that felt like the going to church part, really. Mm. And I guess I've just loved string concertos. It's something that doesn't really, you know, in the abstract, it's not as good as a piano concerto. I mean, like, speaking strictly from a outside-in kind of point of view, if you add a piano to an orchestra, you've actually made the orchestra something more than it was. You've added a new sound that contrasts the orchestra, and also the basic range of the orchestra wasn't diminished at all. You put a violin in front of an orchestra, you haven't added anything you didn't have before, and then all of a sudden the range has to be diminished in order to make the violin concerto work effectively. And we won't even want to talk about what happens if you put a bass in front of the orchestra. but I still love to do it. It's a unique voice. I love the voice of all the string instruments, and so it's just been a natural part of my life to write string concertos. Next week I'll go off and play a double concerto I wrote for Joshua Bell and myself, and we'll play it down in Miami. And it's just something that's always been in my mind, and I think continues to be.
For example, when you wrote for Hilary Hahn, I believe, the violin concerto for this wonderful soloist, did you collaborate? Did you talk to her about what she might want to play, or just go with what was in your head?
Collaboration, I would say, is minimal. It's very interesting. I think I had written a certain amount, and maybe I'd written the first half of it, and she said, oh, I'd like a little more stuff up the G string, a few more double stops. So fine. You know, and there was a point where I could conceive that, and it worked fine. I also remember, hearing her play it before she premiered it, and I told her two or three things to change, and she didn't. And then when I heard her perform it, I decided that she had earned the right to do that because she played it so well. It's one of those weird equations where there is no right and wrong. It's that strength of will that she has that made the thing come to life the way that it did.
Is there any similarity between these outstanding players that you know and consort with, the Joshua Bells and Yo-Yo Ma's and Mark O'Connors? What do they all have in common?
You know, the actual truth is they all play well. The group you just described is quite contrasting.
How is it that you can hang out and play with all of them?
I think I think it's just as simple as, I write, and I also play, and so I'm able to come up with ways to interact with them that are unique in their mind. And without that, I don't know that I would be able to range across all these people so easily.
What are you planning to play on the second half of the concert tomorrow night?
The presentation will be similar, but the music itself will be a little less formal. There'll be few things that are, you know, not original, that, you know, a couple traditional things slipped in, and a range of pieces, you know, starting of, you know, from things that are ranging from things that I wrote 30 years ago to things that I wrote in the last 9 months. And it's less formal music, so I don't do anything that actually fits into a category very cleanly, except maybe the Bach, I guess, is pretty straight up classical. Mm-hmm. But the rest of it, you know, the piece on the first half that I wrote is more formal and probably is a good bridge from the Bach to the second half. It'd be I wouldn't want to present the second half as, you know, lighthearted or just a knee slapping good time. But there is more improvising. There's a little more things stylistically that fit kind of cleanly. You know, there's one feel that's almost more rhythm and blues. There's another one that's a little more trad fiddle kind of feeling. So, you know, you get slightly more focused looks at things that, you know, I think most people would, I hate to use the word, but a lot of people would say it might be a little more fun.
More fun?
A little bit.
Well, if it can appeal to one's sense of dance and rhythm, and others can, like Bach, can appeal to this sense of this universe that actually fits together, mm-hmm. that makes sense. Yeah. And that was maybe the last thing I wanted to ask you today, and it's a bit of a throwback to what we were talking about earlier. You mentioned that you studied mathematics very seriously at one point and chose to do music later, but I've always heard, and I believe, that the math world and the music world are complementary. And is that something you have investigated or think about?
Well, I think for writing music, they're incredibly there's a lot of potential connection. The truth of the matter is that music is so big and so broad that you could have very wonderful ways of making music where you'd have a hard time making an argument that there was a whole lot of math in there. And I don't just mean, you know, numbers. I just mean, you know, kind of logical superstructures. And, you know, I love the idea of kind of creating this whole universe almost from axioms, which is almost what it feels like what Bach does. You know, and I love the idea of discovering things that are obviously true, but the first time you see it, it's not obvious. But once you understand what it is, then you see, oh, clearly this is, you know. And so for me, composing and thinking the way that one thinks in math are very related. I love the idea that a mathematician, you know, when he discovers something of interest, it's a very emotional experience, which is something I'm not sure everybody understands. You know, just the kind of the tying together of the kind of right and left brain type of thinking. And music is wonderful that way. But I don't want to take it too far. But for me personally, the type of thinking that mathematics is for me is very related to music, and especially the writing.
Edgar Meyer, thank you so much for spending this hour with me here on WMUK.
Oh, it is my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you, David.
Thank
for
you.
Bringing Edgar to Kalamazoo. The details on the concert again?
Tomorrow evening at 8 p.m. in Dalton Recital Hall.
Let's take a look at a little piece that will finish this hour, and it's called 1B. Do you have any remarks on this?
Well, you know, the original melody of it, the melody that it starts with, was something I wrote for my son when he was 6 to play on the violin. It was kind of like a little etude, and I just expanded it for Mark and Yo-Yo.